Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage moving on.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly, and during the show we'll be joined by our 250-game veteran of the Victorian Premier League and former Notts County man Dean Hennessy and our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson. It's a huge week in football, always is, but there has been no bigger story from an Australian point of view than the one brewing around Ange Postecoglou, who is being widely reported as favourite to take over the reins at Scottish Premiership powerhouse Celtic. The Hoops need no introduction to any football fan. As we all know, the boys' supporters are some of the most proud and passionate in the world. And while the news might be being greeted as a breakthrough for Australian football, the feedback from the fans has not been so welcoming. The man who broke the story off the back of former Bournemouth manager Eddie Howe pulling out of the race was The Athletic's Oliver Kay, who will join us to help us uncover whether the appointment is actually going to happen and what Ange can expect if he is appointed. And while it's been a few years since Postecoglou was in charge of the national men's side, it seems nearly as long since we've seen the Socceroos in action. And the wait ends over the next week with World Cup qualifying in the Kuwait hub, one of Box to Box's most favourite experts. In fact, he was our very first guest back in 2015. John Cosmina will join us to talk through his expectations of Graham Arnold's men. And of course, the A-League regular season wraps up this weekend with some spots at the bottom of the top six still alive. We'll go through the fixtures and look ahead to the finals to wrap up the hour. In the second hour, Willem will kick off with second edition news and the latest on the Socceroos in camp, and the Matildas, of course, about to play their final Olympic warm-ups. And we'll spend plenty of time talking about football in Europe. First up with Optus Sports' Richard Bayliss to talk through the Euros. We'll talk about the impact that COVID might have, the various challenges from each group, and maybe a bit of a dark horse prediction from him. We'll talk more Europe with Dino and Del, the Champions League and their selections on the Euros. And we've always got something fun with stoppage time, Edge. But how are we going to cram this all in, mate?
I don't know. How would you be if you worked in the national teams unit of Football Australia? You've had 18 months, 20 months of no activity, and all of a sudden, Olleroos, Matildas and Socceroos all playing matches within 3 or 4 weeks of each other and all at the same time. They'll be stretched to the limit, but they'll be loving it, and I'm loving it, because our national teams are back in action, and it's been such a long wait, Willem.
Rob, as you mentioned, the top story this week definitely has been Ange Postecoglou. His reported move to Celtic looks set to proceed, with a six-figure release from Yokohama reportedly agreed. And I say reportedly because it has been a bit of a murky story. There's not actually too much concrete information floating around. Questions have arisen as to whether he possesses the required UEFA coaching licence at this point, a hurdle, of course, faced last year by Kevin Muscat. Rob, as you mentioned, a highly emotional story both here and in Scotland, and wading through all those reports has been difficult at times. But the common thread that has sort of been there throughout the past week, this story broke Saturday morning Australia time, is that there's enough credible voices in Scotland, here in Australia and in Japan as well, that it looks like it is going to happen.
Oh, there's no question that it is genuinely on the brink of happening. All of the credible news sources are reporting it, and what I have noticed day by day, the European press is learning and understanding more about Ange Postecoglou. So they're moving a little from the fiasco of the Eddie Howe scenario to who is Ange Postecoglou, what are his credentials, and they're now recognising him as a serial winner who plays the style of football that Celtic expect, and that he may well have something that the fans over in Scotland are not aware of just yet, which obviously the management at Celtic do, but they don't, the management that is, don't have the respect of the fans as we speak. But Edge, what do you think?
Well, it's been quite entertaining looking at the Twitter feeds of Scottish fans blowing up about who's Ange Postecoglou. And then they thought he was Greek, and now they realise he's Australian. So, that's been an interesting little aspect to it. But, gee, it's all positive, isn't it? It's such a big news story for Australian football, and we all love and respect Ange. So he's
well, we forget he's in contention for the Sunderland job back in 2017 as well. So he's been on the radar for a few years now.
Yeah, this is a great job for him, actually, because I think we all know his approach, his understanding of the game, in particular the connection to clubs, culture and histories, and he will do very, very well. I think the big question that we'll all have, and I'll be interested to when we have the discussion a little bit later on in the show, but is just whether he can hold his temper because we know he can get a bit grumpy, and whether the fans will react to that in any way. In particular, if they have a rough patch early, and whether they want to, you know, get on his back early in his tenure, because we know that his teams take a little while to adapt to his style of play, don't they, Willem?
Yeah, well, that's the big question, if he's going to be given time. And I tend to think that he won't fail. He might just be sacked too early if given the chance by Celtic. So more on that and with Oliver Kay later in the hour. Former Socceroos skipper Mark Milligan will retire at the end of the A-League season and will remain with MacArthur to begin his coaching career under Ante Milicic. Milligan played in 7 different countries and won 80 Socceroos caps across his career, and he's famously one of just 62 men to have been selected for 4 World Cups. And Michael and Rob, he's admitted in the past couple of days that his career probably could have gone to greater levels at club level, but he always put the soccer in the Australian game first, many spells, of course, in the A-League. And, of course, he played a role, it shouldn't be forgotten, in achieving pay parity when he was captain of the Socceroos for the Matildas. So great to see, though. He's not going to be lost to the game, and it's going to be exciting to see what he can do as a coach.
I mean, what a remarkable career he's had. You forget how significant it's been. You know, 4 World Cups, 3 Asian Cups, can captain at the 2017 Confederation Cup, Beijing Olympics in 2008, 80 international caps, not to mention the how many A-League clubs did he play for?
Well, he started at Sydney, then went to Newcastle, then Victory, and then MacArthur at the end.
Yeah, so, wow, what a career. He's a superstar of Australian football. Do you think he gets recognition for that, Rob?
No, I don't think so, outside of football, that he does. I think within football he does, but as a genuine Australian sporting icon, I don't think he does. But hopefully that'll resolve itself in the future, because on top of all of that, he's just a good bloke.
He is, because I had an opportunity to... I bumped into him at the Women's World Cup in 2019 in France, and we had a cup of coffee, and he was just all over it. He knew ins and outs of the Matildas and what was going on. I mean, he's just a very decent football person.
Over to South America, a huge story brewing here. Argentina has been stripped of the Copa America hosting rights 2 weeks before it was set to begin, as they face an increase in COVID-19 cases. CONMEBOL has stated Brazil will host the tournament instead, to the light of President Jair Bolsonaro, although his chief of staff has warned the deal is not yet official. Bolsonaro has been widely criticised for opening the doors to his country, which has lost over 460,000 lives during the pandemic. Michael, this Copa America, as we get closer to kickoff date, is unfortunately just getting sadder and sadder. Firstly, there'll be no Colombia. They were set to be a host. Now there'll be no Argentina. And I say no Argentina. The teams will be there, but they won't be hosting it. We're not going to have the traditional format with the guest sides as well. This is an instance where a tournament hasn't been rewarded for pushing on.
Yeah, so South America is in the grips of its fourth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's very, very serious. Peru during the week revised up their deaths from 80,000 to over 350,000. They now are the worst performing country per head or per capita in the world. So Colombia's teetering on the precipice of economic failure. So there is some really serious stuff happening in South America. And in the context of that Copa America, you just wonder whether they might have stuck it away. Well, put it away.
Oh, yeah, but I know. My refrain has been similar throughout. I just talk about the mental health of the people, and look, if it's that bad, how much worse can it be? Let's say we're assuming that fans aren't allowed to travel. That if the only travellers are the players and their support crew, then geez, it can't get any worse than it is. And you've got to give the people some respect.
Well, he's got the Brazilian borders are open, so that's the approach that they've taken. So you will be able to travel if you're from South America anyway. Yeah.
Over to Europe, Thomas Tuchel's Chelsea were on Saturday crowned champions of Europe with Kai Havertz's goal, the difference in the final against Manchester City.
Ederson off his line. Havertz! Chelsea in front. Kai Havertz, with his first ever goal in the Champions League, has made the breakthrough.
Chelsea midfielder N'Golo Kante was adjudged man of the match, while City boss Pep Guardiola was criticised for leaving Kante's opposite number, Fernandinho, out of his 11. It was Chelsea's second European triumph following the Roberto Di Matteo-led win of 2012. Rob, I think that it's nice that, as a neutral, Chelsea got at least one of the 3 major honours they were up for as a club, including the FA Cup and the Women's Champions League final. And for City, that all-important European Holy Grail goes unattained for at least a year longer.
Yeah, it does. And I know we're going to reflect on our selection questions in the second hour of the show, so I'll just park some comment about that until
always about
we
it.
Have
he likes
that.
To make it about himself, doesn't he?
Really? No, what makes you assume that I'm going to do that anyway? You'll have to wait.
Did
until
you see
that happens.
Patrick?
Hang on, he's asked me a question. I'm trying to respond to it.
No, and, I've made a comment.
The point that we're making here is no. I said Willem's asked me a question.
Oh, okay, I see.
Is that he was outthought Guardiola by Tuchel. There's no question about that. N'Golo Kanté, he just had the free run of the midfield. There was a story I heard about during the week where ESPN put up the three great midfields of all time, and I can't remember the two sets of three off the top of my head, but the third one was N'Golo Kanté on his own, and he played.
he plays like three people, doesn't he?
Yeah. So we'll talk about it more in a second. Now
back home now, APL managing director Danny Townsend has indicated the A-League may return to the October to May schedule following last week's new broadcast partnership. Speaking on the global game, Townsend also said breaking for FIFA windows is firmly on the agenda. Any decision over domestic match calendars will have to be agreed with Football Australia, who retained control over that aspect of the game during the New Year's independent split. Michael, you and I have been pretty firm on that a winter switch isn't the way to go for the A-League going forward, so I'm strongly in favour of the return to the October start. Midweek games, we've seen this year that they can work. We've had far too many of them, in my opinion, but that's because of the condensed coronavirus season. So I think we'll just go back to playing matches on weekends, and then you can have your international breaks and slot in a few midweek matches to accommodate for that. Not too far from what we started with.
Well, the mail I hear is that the timing of the season is locked into the broadcast deal, and despite Football Australia's efforts to have the winter seasons aligned, it won't happen because it's commercial suicide if they do.
Okay, we're going to talk to Oliver Kay from The Athletic. Oliver had a great career with The Times before he became one of the big names that The Athletic poached, and he is one of the authorities on European football and wrote an article this week about Ange Postecoglou off the back of Eddie Howe. So we want to get a bit of a sense of his thoughts on how this played out and what he forecasts is going to happen from Europe and on the ground over there. Stick around. It's going to be an interesting chat with Oliver Kay from The Athletic after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe
for Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving, and more.
And this could be the most.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. Now, earlier in the week, when the story about Ange Postecoglou blew up, we all looked at the copy we were reading and thinking, "Is this for real?" We've all known Ange has had aspirations to coach in Europe for many, many years. We know his stated ambition is to coach Liverpool one day, but he, as we know, has got the pedigree. He's coached Australia. He's won an Asian Cup. He's won the J-League with Yokohama F. Marinos, and it is legit. We know that a man who wrote a story on this very issue is a senior sports writer with The Athletic. I've read his copy for many years with The Times, Oliver Kay, and he's on the line right now. Oliver, how are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks, guys.
So, Oliver, were you just as dumbfounded when you heard the name Ange Postecoglou as we were to see that he was in contention?
I was surprised. I mean, I'll be honest, I'm not somebody who's all over Australian football or Japanese football. I'm very familiar with the name, and obviously with Obu from the World Cup, and I remember that he was at Yokohama, but I hadn't really heard of him linked, you know, with this vacancy at Celtic. All the talk was of Eddie Howe, and then those talks of Eddie Howe collapsed at the end of that last week, and it emerged that they've been talking to Ange Postecoglou for some time, and it seems that they're close to an appointment there. It seems to have moved on, particularly over the last few days, but it was felt to be very much moving in that direction. And yeah, it was a surprise because so much of the talk had been of Eddie Howe, and then sort of a number of Scottish managers, and then people like Roy Keane and Ange Postecoglou had kind of gone under the radar a bit, I would say, in terms of this is kind of it.
So, Oliver, you know, we know we've had success, or we're sending Australian sporting coaches to England over the years. Trevor Bayliss, of course, won the Ashes. Eddie Jones nearly won the Rugby World Cup. So in terms of sporting pedigree, we know that the UK, in Scotland, that we're recognised as sports people, but certainly not for football. So insofar as the Eddie Howe story is concerned, that really was a story that unravelled very, very quickly. To suggest that Ange Postecoglou was sitting there waiting in line, that seems to have gotten under the nose of the fans at Hampden Park. On one hand, they were waiting for Eddie Howe to be announced, and then suddenly the management's got Ange Postecoglou lined up and ready to go.
To be honest, I think if any of Celtic fans are thinking they shouldn't have lined up an alternative, I think they're absolutely right to have lined up an alternative, because those talks with Eddie Howe dragged on for more than 2 months, and I sort of got the impression, I mean, I know he was sort of nailed on with a bookmaker saying appointment any day now, and I'd spoken to people who were more sceptical about whether it would happen, so I thought, well, I hope Celtic aren't putting all their eggs in the Eddie Howe basket, because if this falls down, they're going to be left with a blank canvas on at the start of June. It appears that they had, to their credit, got a plan B lined up, and I'm sure there'll be people saying he shouldn't be anybody's plan B, but it's a great club, and it would be a great job for him to get, especially when he's been lusting to get to Europe for such a long time.
We have been amused and entertained with the reaction to just the mention of Ange Postecoglou in the early news reporting. Australian football fans were getting online and sharing some of the outrageous comments by the Scottish football fans. It was obviously they didn't know who he was. Then they thought he was Greek. They didn't know he was Australian. Then they worked out he coached Australia at the World Cup and then a Japanese club. So we did see the response was, I mean, it was fairly predictable, but it was pretty entertaining. I mean, has there been a lot of talk about Ange Postecoglou who? Has there been a lot of European football luminaries who you just thought, who is this bloke?
I think, as I said, just being really honest, I mean, I remembered him from the World Cup, and I knew he was working in Japan now, and I'd probably seen his name crop up occasionally, but because my focus is all on European football and particularly English football, and to a lesser extent Scottish football. He's not a name that I was massively familiar with his CV and his philosophy and so on. And I've read up a lot of people, on him over the last week or so, and I've spoken to a few people within the game, and they say, "Oh no, he's really good," and they point out that the fact that he was hired by the City Football Group, it's not just we see coaches move to the J League or J1 League as it is now, and it doesn't necessarily mean they're elite coaches, but he was hired by the City Football Group, which obviously owns or part owns Yokohama, and that was said to me to be a significant endorsement of how good he is. And I've read a lot over the last few days where people have been absolutely raving about him, and ex-players have been raving about him and saying, the way he engages, the way he inspires players and the football he insists on and the way he motivates. Something that Celtic fans will really want to. And funnily enough, Eddie Howe had been the favourite, and he's a really good manager. I mean, he worked absolute wonders in English football with Bournemouth. But there was a bit of scepticism among some Celtic fans about him. Despite being somebody who'd been linked with Arsenal and linked with the England job in the past, and linked with Everton and West Ham and stuff, there was a sense that he's some outsider who's coming to Glasgow. Is he going to get it? Is he going to get the Scottish football team, the Old Firm rival? So I think it's the same questions really that will be asked about Ange Postecoglou. And from what I can gather about his personality, he will absolutely relish the rivalry and embrace that rivalry and embrace the passion of the Celtic fans and sort of try to harness that, because it's a unique job, I would say. So, well, I mean, Celtic Rangers are unique jobs in that you have to be successful at those clubs. It's not like being at a mid-ranking Premier League club or an ambitious Championship club. There's so much pressure on and focus on those managers. Steven Gerrard has done brilliantly at Rangers to turn it around. Brendan Rodgers did brilliantly at Celtic prior to that. But you don't want to go there and be the second best team in Glasgow.
On behalf of all the Australian fans who love Ange Postecoglou, just what is he walking into? I did read that a few weeks ago the Celtic CEO had his house firebombed and his car set alight. So the level of passion and intense, as you mentioned, scrutiny on the coach. But just for Australian listeners, just how hostile will the fans be if things don't go well for Ange Postecoglou?
Well, the Peter Norwell, the thing with the chief executive's house, it is really not clear what went on there and who was behind it and whether it was anything linked to football or indeed to Celtic or anything like that. I wouldn't want to sort of lump that in with the sort of discussing the melting pot of Glasgow football. But it is genuinely, I would say, it's a much fiercer rivalry than any of the rivalries that we have in the Premier League in England. It's a unique rivalry. I mean, it's, you know, it was based on religion and in the past, and I think it is still to a small extent. But it's like the football rivalry has overtaken the religion, and it is fierce. If you've been to an Old Firm game, it's really fierce. And as I said, you don't want to be the manager of the second best team in Glasgow. Neil Lennon, who was managing Celtic last year, I think the first nine games, I think it was, they won eight and drew one. Everything seemed to be fine. They went to this Old Firm game against Rangers in perhaps late October or thereabouts. They lost that, and the world turned against Neil Lennon, who was a great Celtic player, had success in his previous Spurs manager, had success in his second Spurs manager, but suddenly, because they were no longer top dog in Glasgow, there was intense pressure on him, and that negativity sort of just overcame the whole club, really, and he ended up sacked in February, and there were protests against him, and it's not somewhere where you want to go, and I would imagine that if you succeed at Celtic or you succeed at Rangers and you turn the tide as Steve Gerrard has and as Martin O'Neill did previously and Graeme Souness did with Rangers back in the 80s, you will rarely get hero worship like that as a manager, because the fans there are so passionate, being so much to them. The flip side of it is that if you go there and fail as Pedro Caixinha did, Portuguese manager who took over at Rangers. You go there and fail, you are derided. It's not pleasant. You can go there and sort of just do a good job, but not quite be able to turn the tide, and it will be difficult. So I think it's very, very important for Ange Postecoglou, if he goes there, as we expect him to, it's very important for his credibility that he sort of has a few early wins and doesn't make a slow start and doesn't come off second best in that first Old Firm game against Rangers and doesn't have an embarrassing result in Europe as a lot of Celtic and Rangers managers that have done in more recent years. It's so pressurised anyway, and I think that pressure just builds and builds and builds if you don't get an early couple of wins under your belt. And that would have been the same for Eddie Howe as well, had he gone there and not been able to sort of emerge from the from the shadow of Steve Gerrard's Rangers. So it's very, very pressurised job. And the other thing that just, sorry for rambling on, but I was reading about Postecoglou and his relations with the media. He's very abrasive, very feisty, very outspoken. That could be a really good thing in terms of just making him a sort of cult figure and making the fans really rally around him. As long as his sort of feisty relationships with the media are conducted from a position of strength, as long as results on the pitch are good, I think if results aren't what he would like, and if it's a bit of a slow start, which would be understandable, and if he's then sort of fighting fire with the media, that can become more problematic, I think. So I think a lot of it will be dictated by results.
Oliver, it's fascinating to listen to you talk about it. We know Ange as far. Several of us have been on the sharp end of his death stare, and he knows how to give it. But hopefully, as you say, it is on the end of some good results. We're talking about the proud club of the Lions of Lisbon, who, you know, as anyone who is listening would most likely know, that Celtic are the first ever team to have won a European or the equivalent of the Champions League back then. And I think if I was Ange, I'd be getting on my knees and saying a prayer to Brother Walfred, the Maris brother who founded Celtic all those years ago back in 1887, because he might need every single thing going for him. But look, he's a chance. He's been a serial winner, and hopefully for Celtic and Australian football's sake, he's a success. Oliver, thanks for joining us. We're really grateful. We didn't get to talk about England and the Euros. We do wish you well. We you know, we only hate you when we play the Ashes.
Really?
Yeah.
No, not really.
it didn't sound like it. Yeah, we do wish you well. We do wish you well.
No,
thank you.
Good on you. Oliver Kaye from The Athletic. Thanks for joining us, mate.
Good.
Okay, stick around. We're going to talk to John Cosmina, our very own Socceroo, the first guest ever on Box to Box. We're going to talk Socceroos.
All those years ago, break. Rob. 2015. Yes, seems correct. Like only yesterday.
On Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
It's been a long, long time since we saw the Socceroos on the park. Well, matches have been played in Europe, competitive matches, and even in the Middle East, where our boys are right now trying to contend in the second round of World Cup qualifiers. One of our favourites, in fact, our very first guest I said off the top of the show on Box to Box back in 2015 was soccer legend himself, John Cosmina. Welcome back to the show, Cosy.
Thanks, Rob. Was it that long ago?
It was, mate. It was that season where the Leicester City defied the odds 5,000-1, and you were the very first guest we had on our show, mate.
Well, how about that?
So
it's pretty impressive, Cos, isn't it? I mean, we've all lost a few brain cells by then, but I'll tell you, someone who maybe not have lost some brain cells is Graham Arnold. But I just want to get your opinion, obviously being a former cockroach of great pedigree. How do you think he's feeling after it's been, 560 days since the Socceroos have been together? They've been thrown together in difficult conditions in the Middle East when it's very, very hot, and they've got a number of games that normally we would expect it to sort of sail through. But how do you think Graham Arnold's feeling at the moment?
Oh, look, he's like anybody, mate. He's only human. He'll be somewhat apprehensive, but Arnie's fairly confident. He's really, I guess, defined a way of going about coaching with the national team. He's always very, very positive about the outcomes, almost trying to predict an outcome to create one. To some extent, but look, Arnie's like any coach, I suppose. He is happiest when he's in a tracksuit with a pair of boots on out on the pitch, and he hasn't been able to really do that for quite a while now. Getting into camp, especially after such a long hiatus, will be such a motivator for him. He'll be buzzing. So I think that sort of, the men will reflect on the playing group as well, and I expect them to be buzzing tomorrow morning as well.
The teams that we're coming up against, some of them have had pretty ordinary preparation. Some of their leagues have been in recess, not really playing. In the Middle Eastern competitors, this time of year they don't normally play, so it's it could, in one hand, the weather might work in their favour, but on the other hand, the whole component of our A-League contingent might work in our favour, because they're coming out of what's been a very competitive season. Do you, obviously there's four games in quick succession, so the squads will be rotated heavily, but what do you think about the squad he's put together, and in particular some of the A-League entrants for the first time, Ruan Tonjic in particular from Central Coast? What are your thoughts on that?
Arnie will stick with the tried and true bloke, the ones that have done the job for him in the past, but I think it's he's talked about this, and Ange Postecoglou did as well. You need to have you can't just have a squad of 20-odd players. You've got to have 30-plus minimum that can step into the breach any time that's necessary. But I think they'll all get game time because of the conditions. But he's got a big squad there, and it's great to see that you've got someone like Ruan Tonjic, who a couple of years ago wasn't on the scrap heap, but he certainly wasn't setting the world on fire at Melbourne City when he was there. You know, he'd left Adelaide and things weren't going that well, but he found a new lease on life. at the Mariners, and he's had an exceptional season. He's been outstanding, and one of the major reasons that they're not third at the moment, but they're in the top six and pretty much assured of a place in the final. So, but you've got your Jamie McLaren's as well, and Ryan Grant, and Ryan McGowan's back in the squad as well, which is an interesting one. So that'll have an impact, obviously, on the local competition and the finals coming up. But your national team's always a bit more important than your local club stuff. And I think it's great that we've got a strong contingent of A-League players in what you'd call your larger national squad.
This is Box to Box. We're talking to legend of Australian football, John Cosmina, and a bloke who just exploded into the public consciousness over the weekend was Kenny McDougall with Blackpool at Wembley. I mean, you don't fluke two goals in a big playoff match like that to get your team promoted for fun. So, I mean, he's a guy that... as I said, it's flown under the radar. What's your knowledge of him? Is it your opinion? Can he be one of the players that makes the difference for us?
Well, you look at your Jackson Irvine type character, which is what Kenny Dougal probably like. He's a hard-working, a grafting midfielder. You know, playing in the lower leagues in the UK, he actually played at the club I coached at previously, Brisbane City, as a youngster before going to Holland. So, you know, he didn't play a lot in Holland at a really high level, but. The fact is that it's a good school, the Dutch football, and he learned a bit there, and he's certainly grinding it out in the competition at Stoke, not with Stoke now, with his team that won on the weekend. I think he can be a bit of a bolter, but you know he'll do a job for the national team. It's good to see you know players like him that have gone overseas and chanced their arm and. Have flown a bit under the radar. I mean, he's been on the fringes of selection, I think, for quite a while now. I mean, the one thing that Arnie has done exceptionally well is he's found anyone remotely possible to have Australian heritage that's possible to play for the Socceroos. He's tracked them all down and kept an eye on them. So he's
done very. How did he do that? He's done very well. You know, Harry Souttar, obviously, Martin Boyle. I mean,
he missed Lyndon Dykes though.
He did miss Lyndon Dykes, but he's lifted rocks up everywhere, isn't he? How do you actually do that?
No, you just got to ask questions.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all of these kids have, like Martin Boyle might be a different case, but if you start asking around, you ask enough questions and you ask enough people, sooner or later you're going to find some answers. And you come up with some good ones. I mean, Harry Souttar's one that...
He's a good one, yeah.
He's actually progressed a hell of a lot. And he could become a mainstay for a long time because he's only, 24 years of age or something?
Just on that, Cozzy, before Willem asks you a question, if China had blooded two players in their national team that had never been to China previously, the first time that they'd ever been to China was the day that they played for China, we'd be asking questions. So surely some other
who was that Canadian bloke that won us a gold medal a few years ago in the skiing and he'd never been to Australia?
Yeah, exactly.
We claimed him,
that's right. So Harry and Martin, they'd never been to Australia until they'd actually put on a shirt. I mean, that is a bit unique.
Aussies through and through.
It's different, but look, they qualify as Australian citizens. So the rule is what it is, and you've got to make the most of that. Take advantage of it. You know, you can't turn around. You've got a fantastic centre-half or a great natural dribbling wide midfielder or attacker. You know, just because they hadn't been to Australia but they've got Australian parents, it doesn't mean they're not Australian.
That's true.
John, the world's a much bigger place or a much smaller place than it used to be. Used to be big because we couldn't travel, but now it's small. So, you know, it's quite – and I think you'll see more of that kind of circumstance over the years to come. A lot of parents, you know, families end up – you know, the kids are born here, but they move overseas at a young age. It's like my days in the Socceroos when a lot of the – you know, you could ask, I guess, the question in reverse. A lot of the Socceroos I played with are actually – born in the UK or in Europe, and come out here and take an Australian citizenship. So it's the same sort of thing in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, fair point.
John, just going back to the midfield, it's the one part of the field which I'm looking most forward to watching across this group of qualifiers. It's probably where we're a little bit short heading in. No Aaron Moy, Luongo, Tom Rogic, these guys have been mainstays for the past sort of 5 years. Jimmy Jego missing as well. In their place, been selected Connor Metcalf, Riley McGree, Denny Jeanrot, three guys who have all come through the A-League. How well placed do you think the A-League has them to make an impact in these qualifiers and going forward?
Denny Jeanrot has blossomed at Melbourne City. Is it MacArthur? I mean, he's at MacArthur, isn't he? And Riley McGree, I was just reading an article about him, how much he's actually improved because he's just played a bucket load of games at Birmingham. So he's really, really comfortable. So, and look, he was a great player before he left. He was a virtually laid down was there, and I'm glad to see he's in there. And who was the other one you mentioned?
Connor Metcalf.
Yeah, Connor Metcalf's the one that I think's improved a lot. I mean, he's still young, but he's had a standout season at Melbourne City as well. And, I mean, he was on the fringes. You know, he's obviously an Olympic player as well. But he, I think he's been sensational for Melbourne City this year. Very, very solid. You know, whether he plays a little bit deeper and can play that holding role, or he loves to get forward and can attack. He's very, very comfortable on the ball. So I think it's exciting to get players like that in the competition. And then you've still got your Moyes and your Rogiches and Luongos to be available further down the track.
Yeah, true. You've got to blood these players, don't you? Cozzy, great to have you back on. Great to be talking about the Socceroos again. We'll obviously have a more difficult time in the third round of qualifying as things get really serious, but we should get through this without, too much difficulty, and hopefully we can be optimistic. It's next year, the World Cup, about appearing in Qatar 2022. Thanks for joining us, Cozzy.
Not a problem, guys. Thanks.
John Cosmina, talking Socceroos. Okay, stick around after the break. We are going to talk A-League. We're going to wrap up the regular season, which finishes this weekend, and we're going to look ahead to the finals, which it should be a really exciting competition. I don't think Melbourne City are a walk-up start for this one. There's a few contenders who might just spoil the party. So stick around. A-League after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
This is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News, TalkSport. Enjoyed our chat with Cozzy. Takes us back, nearly 6.5 years ago to when we first started the show. He's always been good to us, the great man. As have Chemist Warehouse, of course. We wouldn't have had a show if it wasn't for Chemist Warehouse. Mario Tascone, Rutin and Farakala, the great men, my friends. Out at Chemist Warehouse head office. Get great savings right now at that very place, Chemist Warehouse. There is INC, plant protein chocolate or vanilla, 1 kilogram variants for $34.99 each. I like my Harmony Singers. 25% off the Bondo Protein Vegan 1 kilogram range, now just $29.99 each, and 40% off the entire Musashi range. Remember, Chemist Warehouse is making it easier for you to get your essential items. In addition to visiting your local store, you can click and collect to save time at chemistwarehouse.com.au or order online by Australia Post and get free shipping on orders over $50, or call and ask for same-day home delivery. Fees and charges may apply. Chemist Warehouse, where the great savings gentlemen are every single day. And that voice in the background, of course, was our friend Michael Burrows from Brand Music, who wrote and composed that jingle and whose studios we have broadcast this show on.
Was that his cash register as well? Ka-ching.
It would have been. Well, we've seen his studios. He loves a little of memorabilia in those studios, doesn't he?
He does indeed. Hope Michael's going well. We are getting to the business end, the pointy end of the A-League season, guys, and finally we're starting to work out who is actually going to be in the top six. We've had a couple confirmed this week, which are pretty important, or quite good, if you like, for want of a better term, for different reasons. They are Brisbane and the Central Coast Mariners. The Roar, of course, beat Perth on Wednesday night. That's going to be their 12th finals appearance in 16 seasons of the A-League.
I think it's 10 of 11, too. Yeah,
10 of the past 11. That's excellent. And he's continued to put faith in youth, as Warren Moon, Wenzel Hall, Dan Zaki and Champness were his front three starters. You'd often see that early in the season, but as the season's gone on, those three guys have stood the test of time, and he's also brought on Jesse Daly and Alex Parsons, who he's found a bit out of at the back end of the season. And for the Mariners, Rob, it's time to gloat. They will be there for the first time since 2013-14. The Graham Arnold era, Rob.
I'm saving my gloating to
see if you can get somebody else in about the Chelsea game, Rob.
No, I won't. That's for next hour. I just love the Central Coast. I love the region, and I want to see it succeed. So I'm just pleased that they didn't fall out of the finals, and they will at least have a chance to play off for the championship title. And I think they deserve to after the season they've had.
And did you get late night call from Gaddy when it was confirmed that they'd be in?
Gaddy, mate, he was just celebrating, tweeting.
He's tweeting his little heart out, wasn't he?
He was a big man. He's very happy.
No, fantastic achievement by Central Coast, and a wonderful coaching achievement by Alan Sajic. So well done to Central Coast. But we shouldn't gloss over the effort of Brisbane and Warren Moon in particular. And didn't Dan Zaki put Perth to the sword? Mm-hmm. He was He was fantastic. And the players that he's put his faith in are young ones primarily, and they've got the job done.
They certainly have. But with the confirmation of those two sides being in the finals, mean that there's a couple that are confirmed as going to miss. Once again, they are Perth Glory and the Western Sydney Wanderers. For Richard Garcia and his Glory side, though, I think it's been a pass mark, his first season in the top job. They had a fair few matches to play in the back end of the season compared to the other sides. They had the fixture build up, and they did try to chase down that points deficit. Nearly got there in the end, but just had a little bit too much to do. Not a pass mark though for Carl Robinson and the Wanderers. We've been trying to work out how this jigsaw was going to play out all season. We finally got an end product, and that is that they're going to miss the finals for the fourth consecutive season. And Rob, his comments pre-game ahead of the Brisbane Raw game were very interested. He said there's not enough vocal leaders in the dressing room. He said, I've brought in all these leaders, but none of them are vocal enough. I have to be the loudest voice, which is disappointing. Now, strangely enough, they went on to win that match, but it's just another sign that still at the end of the season, he's somewhat at odds with a playing group, which he's largely brought in the entire group.
Oh, no question about that. I think it's all on Carl Robinson really here, because it is in on him to select, or was to select the squad. It's in his own image. He's got to find those voices to represent that leadership, and someone who's got a big enough voice and the ability to match to represent that club, which has been on the outer for so many of the most recent years. And as I've said so many times, the A-League needs the Western Sydney Wanderers to be up and about. They were such a colourful and vibrant part of the competition when they first joined. And they've never got their mojo back since they left Parramatta Stadium for the rebuild. And that's just a disappointing thing for the A-League, I reckon.
He's got goopy egg all over his face. Our mate, Mr. Robinson. So he'll have to. It'll be long off season, and he'll have to reboot his change room and find some leaders who can speak.
I think you'd be relieved that Perth Glory, fair pass mark. The Jets, they gave a reasonable account of themselves, even though they're probably going to win the wooden spoon. But
Melbourne victory could still.
Yeah, I know exactly. He's probably relieved that Western United and the victory are banal. But I'm shooting steal your thunder.
Dino, a team that's been under the radar for the past 12 weeks has been Sydney FC. Now, it's probably been fair enough to write them off as having had their worst season under Steve Corica this season, as he's had set such a high bar across his first two. But they now find themselves, put simply, one win away from the grand final. They're going to finish second. They've won their last four. They've picked up points in 11 of their last 12. And they've got the Sydney FC fan dream scenario ticking over, Lafondra and Bobo. Not that people were unsure how they were going to go together, but as the professionals they are, they've found a way to make it work. How do you see them tracking for the finals?
I think Bimby's done a great job there. He's a wonderful coach, obviously under the tutelage of Graham Arnold, and was his assistant for many years. And I think he's just got a really, really good sound understanding of the game and how to behave with the players, whether they're the experienced ones, and just keep them nice and calm, and then look at the young boys and bring them through. And I think they've just got a really good balance. So I'm not really surprised. And I can see them having a real, real hot go here.
Ominously for the rest of the competition, I think Sydney are going to find it easier to replace McGowan, Redmayne and Grant than Melbourne City are to replace McLaren, Metcalf and Good. On to the final point, we're going to talk about the Newcastle Jets, and you might be thinking, why are you talking about the team that are down in 12th and aren't going to play finals? Well, they might just avoid the wooden spoon, Rob. They enter this round just a point ahead of victory, but there's been a few ructions in their coaching ranks. Late on Thursday, Craig Deans has come out and said he's not going to be there next season, or he won't be there as the head coach anyway. We know he's been at the club for a long, long time. Reports, unconfirmed reports at this stage, but just worth putting out there that apparently the three owners of the Jets, being Western United, Western Sydney and Sydney FC, have offered Arthur Pappas, who recently had the job at Kagoshima in Japan, to come and be the new boss. They've offered him an A-League equivalent of a war chest to come and rebuild the club and make them more attractive to potential buyers to get the club off the hands of those three competitors.
Well, they need to do something about that, because it was only a stopgap measure all along. The Jets did, under the circumstances, a reasonable job of competing at different stages of the season, and Craig Deans is to be applauded for that. So if he's making that decision on his own right, then I think he deserves a pat on the back for making the best of a bad lot under the circumstances. All right, well, that's A-League. That's the end of our first hour of this show. We are going to focus on Europe in the next hour of the show. We're going to talk to Richard Bayliss from Optus Sports with the Euros just around the corner. We're going to wrap up the Champions League and the Europa League as well, and we are going to wrap it up with Stoppage Time with a conversation that we're all very interested in, the press conference in sport. Does it need to exist in the current format? All right, stick around. That's after the news on Box to Box.
Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbus and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and
moving. Absolutely fantastic!
Yes, welcome back to Box, a big second hour coming up very soon. Well, in fact, it's coming up right now. Second edition news with Willem van Denner, and shortly he's going to go through all of the comings and goings of the Socceroos and the Matildas in what is a very, very busy period of time. We're going to talk to Optus Sports, Richard Bayliss. The Euros are just a week away, and Richard is going to be watching every single moment of it. We'll be watching it with him. He's going to break down the entire tournament for us and pick some winners as well. We're going to talk more Europe with Dino and Del, reflect on the Champions League and the Europa, as well as a bit more on the Euros as they come up, and we'll wrap it up with Stoppage Time. Willem?
We've got a massive Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green and Gold Army, Rob, and we've got a massive few years coming up for our national teams. There'll be World Cups, Asian Cups, a home World Cup, of course. Take the first step this week and sign up to the Green and Gold Army mailing list at ggatravel.com.au. Michael, Tony Gustafsson this week has named a 25-player squad for the Matildas' upcoming friendlies against Denmark and Sweden. And the bigger mission, of course, is Lisa Devanna. Recalled are Steph Catley and Elise Callum-Knight, while Kyra Cooney-Cross, Charlotte Grant, Courtney Nevitt and Tegan Micah enter the camp uncapped. At the other end of the caps list is Emily Van Egmond. She's played 99 to this stage, so will hopefully become the eighth Matilda to bring up the ton in this camp. They are going to meet in Barstad in Sweden this Saturday, and the first game is on June 11.
Yeah, exciting time for Kyra Cooney-Cross, Courtney Nevin and Charlotte Grant in particular, who have really won their selection off the back of a fantastic W League season. Courtney Nevin was a bit of a bolter. That one was a bit of a surprise. But obviously the huge news, no Lisa Devanna, no Jenna McCormick, no Emma Checker. Okay, so they are sending a message about the future of the Matildas. Obviously, Lisa Devanna, she is the Tim Cahill of Australian women's football. It has been a bit of a sore point about the way she's been treated over the years. My information is behind the scenes that Tony Gustafsson did a good job of explaining the reasons why and giving her motivation to continue to go and be in the hunt for the World Cup. So great to see Steph Catley back. Elise Callum-Knight and Kaya Simon in particular, those two players have played very little football, both coming off long-term injuries and surgery. Whether they actually make it through to the Olympics, there's a bit of a doubt on that. And Ali Carpenter and Tamika Yellop return. They're the big frontliners that will go into this team, and we're looking forward to seeing who will make that big Olympic squad. That's what this camp's all about in these two friendlies.
I'd be lying, though, if I didn't say I was disappointed that Lisa Devanna couldn't get herself into that squad. She's so talismanic, if that's a word, for the Matildas, and has been for so many years. I felt that she deserved a farewell. She seemed to have been playing in good enough form. She was doing the job with Melbourne Victory. We won the grand final, obviously, and she played a big part in that. I know you've talked about her role, and you know she doesn't have the full package anymore, but she still has the strike power and that character that that is so important. But obviously she's not going to go.
Yeah, look, I think he can only take 16 outfielders to the Olympic Games, so I think he's got to have players that can play multiple positions and also back up with short turnarounds after games, and I think that's what's ruled Lisa out. This is not about a farewell for Lisa. My information is that Gustafsson's told Lisa that she's very much in the frame for the World Cup because it's a different scenario, that tournament, and ultimately for Lisa, it was the fact that she's probably restricted in her ability to recover and play in quick succession and also not play full 90 minutes. And that's, I think he has to go with players that potentially can play in two or three positions based on injuries in this tournament.
That's good news.
And that's probably what's ruled out, Lisa.
Not a lot of men's action around club land because a lot of the Socceroos are in camp, but what was played was brilliant. As mentioned with Cozzy, Kenny Dougal has etched his name into Blackpool legend, scoring both goals in their League One promotion playoff against Lincoln City. He netted both goals from outside of the box, one with either foot, if you don't mind, and will now get a second crack at the championship. having played 12 games for Barnsley at the level in 2019-20. And Nikita Rukavica scored his 23rd of the season for Maccabi Haifa in their 3-2 win over Hapoel Be'er Sheva on the final day of the Israeli season. That win saw Haifa lift their first championship in a decade, while Rukavica sealed back-to-back golden boots in the process. And to finish, the Olyroos have gone down 2-1 to Ireland in the first of four pre-Olympic friendlies being played in Marbella. Having been the better side in the first half, in my opinion, they then conceded early in the second. Rami Nazarian restored parity with a fantastic goal from outside the box, but a bit of tired, possibly a little bit slack defending at the end of the match. Will the Irish go up the other end and net the winner? The Olyroos will face Saudi Arabia on Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. Check your local guides on that one. Going back to the Championship playoffs, guys, Brentford are going to play in English football's top flight for the first time since 1947. They disposed of Swansea 2-0. On Saturday. The Bees had previously lost playoff finals in 97, 2002, 2013, and last year, 2020, but looked pretty assured from the outset against the Swans, who finished with 10 men. Further down the chain, Blackpool moved into the Championship with a win over Lincoln, and Morecambe beat Newport County, 1-0 to climb into League One.
Brentford looked very good. They looked very comfortable. Swansea, they just seemed like a team that wanted to kick Brentford off the park, and it felt like that they were their own worst enemies in that game. If they had have played on their own merits, I seriously think they would have done a lot better than that aggressive style that they went out there with, clearly as a game plan to intimidate Brentford.
Yeah, I agree, Rob, and it was, you know, they say that 2-0 is the most dangerous scoreline to be up, but they, even from two goals down, Swansea, there was never a feeling that Brentford didn't have the game in their grasp. There was a player sent off, and from that point, they really just streeted it in for the last 30 or 40 minutes. It was party time. There was really no pressure poured on the Bees, I don't think.
And a great club and a great brand to be exposed to the world through the Premier League next year. It's going to be exciting.
It is going
to. A little bit of squad news ahead of the Euros before we chat to Richard Bayliss. England have defeated Austria 1-0 through Bakary Sacco's maiden international goal in the pre-Euros friendlies, but it has come at a cost, Rob. Trent Alexander-Arnold has injured his thigh, another medical area that they seem to have different terminology for in the UK. I would have called it his quad. Anyway, he was selected as one of four right-backs in their 26-man squad, but he can be replaced right up until tournament kickoff. Elsewhere, tournament favourites France tuned up with a 3-0 win over Wales. Goals coming through Mbappe, Griezmann and Dembele, while Scotland led twice but ultimately drew with the Netherlands 2-2. Rob, it's been a saga in the tabloids of the UK. Trent Alexander-Arnold's non-inclusion in the previous international window, he's now been back in ahead of the Euros. Now he's going to miss altogether. A bit of a shame.
Yeah, I know that he's definitely out just yet, but it is a saga, as you say. I heard Gareth Southgate talking on the BBC, and Gareth doesn't seem to get angry very often, but he was pretty frustrated around some of the articles, and he made it clear that he'd actually called Trent Alexander-Arnold 4 weeks ago and told him to just ignore whatever was written in the press because he was going to be selected. My big concern, and I know that we'll talk about this later in the hour, is just picking injured players: Jordan Henderson, Harry Maguire. Obviously, the squad is there are 26 players, but I just felt that someone in the kind of form that Jesse Lingard was in warranted a spot. From all accounts, listening to the pundits, he brings an incredible character and joy to a camp, and he's the sort of player that the young guys really thrive off and feed. So, as we've seen so many times in tournaments around the world, there's always an injury to a player in the squad, and there always seems to be someone who drops out, and that someone comes in and becomes an important player in the team. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see one of those players, James Ward-Prowse, another that might get picked. Arnold doesn't get to play, one of them will play a big role in the tournament for England.
Over to Belgium, Kevin De Bruyne has avoided surgery on the facial injury he sustained in the Champions League final and remains a chance to feature for them at the Euros, probably in the knockout stages if they make it that far. He suffered an acute nose fracture and left orbital fracture in his collision with Antonio Rudiger, with Roberto Martinez revealing he wasn't going to join Belgium's squad until later on in their preparation anyway. And Michael, they're going to need him. He's now 29. Lukaku is 28. Hazard is 30. This is, of all the clubs or all the nations in Europe, this is a genuine golden generation for Belgium at the moment. They went close at the World Cup. I think the next World Cup's going to be beyond them. So this is, to borrow from some Aussies sporting parlance, they're in the window and it is closing, so they need to win now.
Yeah, I remember the question we asked Martin Tyler, who's pretty much said the same thing, Willem, that this is Belgium's chance to win something. And I think it'll be a... a negative reflection on Belgian football if they don't win something out of this generation.
Yeah, well, I guess we've seen so many golden generations over the history of football, haven't we? Obviously the Dutch and Hungary way back when Ferenc Puskas was in his pomp. The fairy tale always doesn't always come about, does it? Anyway, we will find out because the Euros are not far away. And a man we're going to talk about the Euros with is Richard Bayliss. He's from Optus Sports. It's going to be a massive 6 weeks of football. Richard's going to watch every minute of it. And we're going to talk to him after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most...
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport Broadcasting across Australia. Well, we've been waiting 5 years now for the Euros since Portugal won back all those years ago in France, and the tournament is now upon us. It is going to occur. It is going to occur across many countries in Europe, and the man who's going to host the Australian coverage for Optus Sports is Richard Bayliss, and we welcome him back to the show. How are you, Richard?
I'm very well, thanks, Rob. How are you?
Yeah, mate, we're really good and excited. I mean, any football fan worth their credentials just loves these big tournaments when they come around, and there's just something... We love the World Cup, but there's something special about the Euros, just the pure quality that the tournament has from start to finish at every end. Insofar as the broadcast, before we get into the groups and the logistics of the whole tournament, we're all subscribers to Optus, obviously, but just talk to us a little bit about how the coverage is going to play out across Optus, and you do seem to have down pat, just that spoiler alert scenario, so people can watch as many games as they like without worrying about finding out the scores.
Our coverage model is pretty ambitious. It's extensive. It was actually going to be much more ambitious before COVID hit us, but I'm pretty confident we've got a really cool setup of shows and coverage and shows that support the live coverage as well. I think we're going to offer a lot more access than we've ever had before, both in terms of that stadiums, but also we've got studios in both Sydney and also in London as well. So we'll have coverage in a couple of different time zones, which is nice because, like you say, a lot of people probably will wake up that little bit later and want to watch it how they want on demand or through the mega matches or mini matches or whatever it might be. So, obviously we'll have that spoiler alert protection as always within the app, and our social media channels will be pumping too. So we've got, a warm-up show, 9 p.m. Eastern every night, hosted by Mel McLaughlin and Claude Saviano, which will be a nice way of getting everyone in the mood. We'll go live to all our reporters and pundits around Europe, of which we'll have them stationed in several different countries. And then with the match coverage hosted by myself or Neve Owens, we go from 10:30 p.m. at night Eastern time through till effectively 8:30 in the morning. It's a long old stint, but it'll be worth it because, like you say, the quality of matches will keep us going. And then in the morning, we'll have a breakfast show hosted by Jules Breach with Mark Schwarzer and some great guests like Neil Heskey and Sean Wright Phillips and Lewis Bellamorte. Those guys will be live from London in a studio overlooking the Thames. So, when people wake up breakfast time, want to find out in Australia what happened, they'll have the perfect companion in those guys. So that plus we've got a TikTok live show. We've got a lot of social executions we're lining up. We feel like it's the most ambitious coverage of a tournament we've ever had. And with the Copa America happening at the same time and up the sport, we reckon we might be pretty busy.
Richard, as a fan of the sport like we all are you nervous that at some point a COVID outbreak might decouple one of the favourites or have a big impact in the event? What do you think? Do you think we'll get through the event without COVID having some sort of impact, or do you think it will at some point?
I think it'd be a surprise if we got through it without any type of, hiccup, be that big or slightly smaller, I suppose, in terms of a squad or, a venue. But we've had so many different conversations with UEFA over a 16-month journey now, and also there's been so much football happening across the continent, both at a club level, but also in, UEFA competitions like Europa League and Champions League, that they've got their protocols so down pat that they're pretty confident. And I think by extension, we have to be confident as broadcasters and fans that they will sort that out. I mean, whether or not we get through without any players testing positive, I'm not sure. And also considering that, crowds will be back in all venues because that was part of the stipulation in getting these venues locked in was the ability to have 25% crowds. We lost, unfortunately, Dublin because they could not commit to that, but everywhere else has kind of got those protocols to a point where they're confident. So many vaccines in the UK in particular have been rolled out, and we know that the Indian strain is there, but there's almost this sort of sense of no turning back now. You know, this is almost the coming out party post-COVID for the UK. And, of course, the big games are at Wembley. So, you know, I guess long answer to the question, I hope not. But I think, you know, we need to accept that with the world we're in at the moment, it's probably a matter of just making sure that, you know, people are looked after. And if something does happen, there's, you know, the protocols in place to be able to reduce the impact.
Richard, the groups, there's six groups in total, four teams in each group. There's heaps of chances for various teams to qualify. There's a couple of groups of death in there. Just talk us through the groups and who you're expecting to advance. And, you know, any dark horses there? I like my friends Lati Angelovski, who is a proud North Macedonian, fancies them in their group. Yeah, give us your thoughts on all that, mate.
The best thing, and you touched on it before, Rob, the fact that it's so competitive at the Euros. I mean, there's probably only two or three nations max that you would look at and say, oh, they are minnows. You know, a lot of them have been heavyweights in their own right. And also the other element that comes in is that four of the best six third-place teams will qualify for the knockout stage. So it's one of those things where almost everyone gets a prize. And remember, 4 or 5 years ago, Portugal won it having finished third in their group. So, you know, there are a couple of ways out of jail if you have an ordinary group stage. But going through them, you know, Group A is an opportunity for all four nations because we've got Turkey, Italy, Wales and Switzerland. It starts with Italy-Turkey next Saturday morning. And Italy, while they'll go in as favourites, and they do have obviously some of the star players in that group, they aren't as strong, certainly on paper, as they may have been in years gone past. So I think there's an opportunity there for a Turkey, for instance, who would consider themselves a good chance of going through. So too Wales, of course, if Gareth Bale can star in the tournament, as we've seen before. Group B, actually, to me, is one of great opportunity because Belgium will be the big favourites in this, even if Kevin De Bruyne is not fit for the group stages. You know, they will go through, you would think, and they'll be amongst the favourites. But beyond that, you've got Denmark, Finland and Russia. I actually think Denmark could be one of the underdogs or the outsiders, dark horses, if you like, of the whole tournament because they've got phenomenal players, particularly through the spine, with Højbjerg and also Eriksen, as we know, has been there and done it. I think, you know, they could be one to keep an eye out for. Group C, you would expect Netherlands to go through with Ukraine, Austria and North Macedonia in that group, but it's pretty open otherwise. Ukraine, arguably one of the more impressive sides sort of under the radar the last few years, so they could be one to keep an eye out for. And they have a host venue as well, which is big for them. Group D, probably Australian-wise, in terms of our viewership out here, will be the one that most people keep an eye on because, of course, any time England are involved, particularly with so many games at Wembley and one against Scotland, you can rest assured that so many people will be waking up to watch the Three Lions, maybe ending that 55-year drought in terms of a major tournament. But with Croatia, Czech Republic and, to a lesser extent, Scotland, it won't all be plain sailing and there'll be a lot of pressure on Gareth Southgate. There's no doubt about that. But they will go through to the knockout stages at the very least. Then you've got some of the big dogs, Spain in Group E. They'll go through, whether Sweden, Poland or Slovakia go through. You'd have to think without Ibrahimovic, Sweden probably not a factor in the tournament as a whole. Poland, Lewandowski more likely to go through. And Group F, you know, save the best for last. It's undoubtedly the group of the tournament because alongside poor old Hungary, you've got Portugal, the reigning champions, France, the world champions, and Germany, who we know are a massive powerhouse. They've gone through a bit of a tough period, but they'll say goodbye to their manager, Jurgen Löw, after this tournament. Never count them out. So, you know, amongst, what, 24 nations, I've probably named all 24 of them, and I reckon that possibly, you know, 20 to 22 of them have got a really good claim to going through to the knockouts and 7 or 8 of them can probably win it.
There are some amazing rivalries in the group stages. I mean, obviously we've got England and Scotland, England and Croatia. You've got France and Germany. And in Group B, you've got Russia and Finland. You know, they've nearly been to war about 15 times over the last 60 years. So there is plenty to look forward to. What is the game of the group stage that you're most looking forward to, Richard?
You're 100% right in that there are so many of them. I think the one, given the fixturing and when it's on, I think England against Croatia will be the one.
Yeah, that's the one, isn't it? Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, or France and Germany, yeah.
I think the best thing about England-Croatia is the time it's on. You know, sort of Australian time, Eastern Seaboard time. It's on at 11 p.m, 2 days into the tournament on a
perfect
Sunday night.
Yeah.
There'll be plenty of people out at bars and getting amongst it out here. Hopefully, by the way, you know, in Melbourne, there'll be the opportunity for people to go out and enjoy it with their friends and family. I know it'll be the case everywhere else, but considering they played in a World Cup semi-final only 3 years ago, Croatia arguably aren't as strong as they were then, but you look at their squad on paper, they can absolutely cause an upset here against an England team that possibly, once again, will go into a tournament overhyped. You know, you look at their squad, it's phenomenal. There's no reason why they shouldn't compete. But there seems to be that sort of thing with the England side at major tournaments where the expectation doesn't always match the reality. So, you know, from their perspective, it'd be great to see them go all the way through to a semi-final or a final at Wembley, because the whole place would just light up.
We're a long time on from the 2010 and 14 era when they made a World Cup final and the World Cup semis as well. But the generation coming through is quite refreshing, as we know. De Jong, De Ligt, Donny van de Beek. My question to you is, are those three ready to put a proper stamp on an international tournament? And is the team around them good enough? Or is this perhaps a tournament too early for the Dutch?
Well, one thing, Willem, when I looked at their squad, I sort of forgot about a lot of their fringe players, if you like, and how strong they are. I mean, they don't have really many weak links. I mean, possibly the fact that Frank de Boer is their manager might be the weakest link, because under Ronald Koeman, they were sort of starting to build again. Then he went to the Barcelona gig. So whether or not they can continue the momentum they started to build, I'm not too sure. You think in De Ligt and Frenkie de Jong, they absolutely have the players to be able to compete at that level. Van de Beek, though, hasn't played the minutes. You know, Depay doesn't know where his future is. Luke de Jong is getting that little bit older. Quincy Promes is a great player. They have great players, there's no doubt about it. Whether or not they're amongst that sort of six or seven to win it, I think they might be just outside that. But then again, their group is one that they have to get through. They have to top that group, undoubtedly. So if they do that, they put themselves in a good position, then you're only a couple of games away from a Euro final. So let's not write them out. I know I've sort of said yes or no in the same answer. I want to give you as much hope as possible.
He only listened to the positives of what you said, Richard. Don't worry. Exactly. I was watching his face.
Maybe just go in as outsiders and you can take that in and say no one expects much of us, and we can prove them wrong. But by the way, you've got a couple of fantastic midfielders that a lot of people maybe haven't seen or heard of in Ryan Gravenberch and also Tian Koopmeiners, who's a great player too for AZ Alkmaar. So you've got the players. Can you put it together? That's a big question.
Hey, Richard, thanks for joining us, mate. We really can't wait for the tournament to start. We love the coverage of Optus, and we're all big fans, and watch it every week. We will be watching a heap of it over the course of the next 5 or so weeks, 6 weeks even, once the tournament kicks off. So, yeah, thanks for joining us, mate. We'll have to get you back on during it to see how it's playing out.
Sounds good, guys. Make sure you get your sleep patterns in order now, because it'll be a long month.
That's right, training starts.
I was just thinking through your sleep patterns, Richard.
Spoiler alert. The trick is, make sure you turn your phone off, put it down, turn the silence on, don't look at it when you wake up, and just be careful about how you open it up, because you just don't want to get a result that somebody like Edgley has told me so many times.
So much fun, Richard, when you do that.
Yeah, he does. Okay, Richard.
Good on you, boys.
To sports, Richard Bayliss. All right, stick around. We're going to talk more Europe. Dino and Della are going to get on the line next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be
this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. It's been a fun show so far. We've talked to Oliver Kay from The Athletic about Ange Postecoglou. Johnny Cosmina, our first ever guest, he came back. We were talking Socceroos with him. And, of course, Richard Bayliss from Optus Sports. But we've got Dino and Dell on the line. We're going to talk more or reflect on last weekend's action and look ahead to the final friendlies, etc. Some of the friendly results are already come through. But before we do, our friends at Storage King have got a massive offer on in June. All right, now, if you move in before June 30, you will receive $100 worth of boxes and packing materials free. Conditions apply. If you need to move, you need boxes, you need packing materials, and you need Storage King. You've got to jump onto storageking.com.au to find your nearest store. You will get $100 worth of boxes and packing materials to help with your move. They've got a crack team of storage professionals. They'll help find the right space for your storage soon. And your store with Storage King, the kings of storage, moving, and more. Well, we've got a bit of a reprise there. Thank you, Damo. All right, Damo, boys, we're going to talk more Europe.
Lots of football to talk about. Let's start with the Champions League final. And of course, I think Thomas Tuchel must listen to our show, because we gave him some good advice on how to scupper Pep, and it did. And I think, Rob, if I'm not mistaken, I think we may have done okay in the prediction stakes.
Yeah, I think a couple of us did. We're just going to have a listen to last week's, or at least one of last week's tips.
And what about you, Rob? You're an underdog man. Chelsea are hardly an underdog with the way that they are, but can you see it being the Werner final?
I can, and I am going to tip the underdog to win. I think that there's no more pressure on Chelsea now. I know you and I are talking about it during the week. I thought that if they had to play for a Champions League position, and we talked about the doomsday scenario a couple of weeks ago, which should have played out if Leicester City hadn't have just choked at the death, then I wouldn't have been prepared to tip them. But now the pressure's off, they know they've won. Thomas Tuchel is a master strategist, and I think he'd get some free rent in Pep Guardiola's head, and he'd be extra worried about him because he's done it before already this season. And look, they've got the firepower if Tuchel can get it together. And look, I think the key is if N'Golo Kante is fit. He plays the role of 2-3 players, and for me, he's the difference.
Edge, is it going to be the perfect swan song for Sergio Aguero?
It is, yeah. They have too much quality in my book, and they'll get the job done. And I think it'll be a lot more comfortable than what Rob was explaining.
Do you have anything to say?
Congratulations. What I have to say is...
Oh, he moves along.
What I have to say is this show's not about you, Rob. The show's about Chelsea.
Well, I'm just going to take the occasional victory where I get them, and if you don't blow your own trumpet, nobody else will.
That's right.
So, Michael, just please remember
But you're
that.
Right. Thomas Tuchel is one of the best coaches in the world, and he's taken Chelsea to their second Champions League trophy in just 4 months. It's a pretty amazing effort, Derek. I've got a question for Derek. How English is English football? This Champions League final, England fans might have been gloating about the All England final, and I noticed some of their fans misbehaved a little bit in Portugal too, but only 9 players who started were English, 4 at Manchester City and 5 at Chelsea. Both clubs' owners are non-English and the coaches non-English. So just how English is English football, Derek?
Well, it was a very English final because, as we know, every time English teams play each other in this final, it's a rubbish game. And to be fair, it wasn't stellar. There was some tension there at the end, but it wasn't stellar. Not many English players on the pitch. And to be fair, Manchester City have been cultivating a few, though. We'll look forward to seeing Ben Foden. Phil Foden and... Raheem Sterling lining up for England in a few days from now. But, good point, well made. It had a continental flavour with the two continental managers and two very different styles. But it wasn't the Werner final, was it, Dino? It was more the Kante final.
Yeah, Kante was superb. I mean, every blade of grass. And not that you expected that. And for me, he was man of the match. But I thought Havertz did well, and even Werner. And I think overall, Chelsea definitely deserve to win their game.
Dino, you've lived in America, so you'll appreciate this. Just a little bit of a side note about the Champions League is that CBS, the new partners for the A-League in Australian football, they took the match on their primary free-to-air channel in the US. On the eastern states, it was the match kicked off at 3 o'clock, and they had a programming from 12:30 p.m. until 5:30 p.m. Pretty impressive on their free-to-air national television network. They had 5 hours of football in America. That's never been done before in the States, so it just proves maybe CBS is going to be good for Australian football.
I have lived in America. And in the days then, it was very hard to get a lot of games that you could watch, they did actually still pan to the English, but it was more like a few chosen games that they would look at. But now I think with all the new platforms, I think it's I think they really love the British type of game and especially the major tournaments. So I think from an American point of view, I think it'll still go very, very well, as it did even when I was there.
It, of course, wasn't the dream final for Sergio Aguero in the end. You know, he bowed out with the loss there, but he now joins Barcelona on a 2-year deal. He says that Barcelona are the biggest and best club in the world, so he seems to have moved on quite quickly. Is that a good move for Barca?
Yeah, look, I think so. I mean, you can still see, like, even in the games when he was playing just at the back end of the season where, he could still finish. And look, he'll be used most probably, and looked after in regards to not playing every single minute of every game. But look, he's still a great predator, and I think he'll do really well in Spain because I think it will be a little bit easier than it is in England.
I think that's just where Barcelona is, to be honest with you, Dino. I don't think they're in a position to spend 100 million euros on a striker. And if you can get someone of Aguero's quality for free, I think that's what you've got to do. Before we move on to Euro 2020, there's been quite a bit of managerial activity around England and Europe in particular. Of course, Nuno's gone from Wolves, and that's, they've already replaced him with another Portuguese who I don't think anyone in the studio would have heard of before. And the big one, you know, Zidane leaving Real Madrid, and then Carlo Ancelotti leaving Everton to go to Real Madrid. First of all, Dino, how are Everton going to be feeling about that?
It's poor form, really, because if you think about it, when he went there, especially when he was paraded, like with the new stadium they're going to build and it's going to be here and see it all through. And I think it was about a 5 or 6 year contract. But realistically, it's not worth the paper it's written on, is it? You know, he's just gone away. They're finished in a poor position, really. And for me, you know, well, let's see how he goes on his next venture and see how he goes. But, I mean, I just think it's really poor form on his behalf. And I hope Everton do get a decent manager.
Not the most impressive Everton season. You know, 10th is really poor, you know, for them, given the level of investment and the aspirations of the club. But they're talking about David Moyes possibly returning. I know Farid, the owner didn't want him the last time, but he's now proven himself. Nuno, the ex-Wolves manager, and possibly even Rafa Benitez, who...
I heard Steven Gerrard's name mentioned this afternoon.
Steven Gerrard, yeah. But Benitez still lives on Merseyside, and Carragher thinks he could do a job there. And yeah, possibly. Gerrard's going to be linked with every major English job, to be honest with you now, because he's got that...
What a story that would be, though.
That track record. Would he go to Everton? That's a tough one. I think Carragher would, because he was an Everton fan who played for Liverpool. But we all know Gerrard is a red through and through. But then Zidane leaving as well. Do you think Zidane can go anywhere, Dino? He just seemed to have that right set up. He had all that success at Real Madrid. But can you see another club going and taking a chance on him?
Yeah, look, I mean, I have mixed feelings, obviously, the way he treated Gareth Bale. And I know Gareth most probably had a lot to do with part of that. But if you look at his record when Gareth was there, and even then he wouldn't play him, even when he'd won like three Champions Leagues in a row. I don't know. I'm not a really big fan of him, to be honest. So I'm not really bothered wherever he goes. As long as he don't come to Derby, that's all I'm talking about.
Oh, I don't know if a beggars can be choosers, to be honest with you, Dino. But next big question is, how many right-backs is too many right-backs? And I'm talking here about the England squad. They've only got three now because of Trent's injury. But what did you think of that squad overall?
Yeah, look, I think... And I've been listening to it for the whole of the week, really. It's all about trying to get a balance, you know, in your squad. And the thing is, and I do get it, like Trent, I still think Trent eventually will be a midfielder and playing maybe even in the middle of the park and creating. But at the moment, yeah, how many do you have? I mean, it's ridiculous to have five right backs in the squad. And I know a couple have dropped out now through being dropped out and also injured. So, yeah, look, I can't really understand it. And I just don't think the actual full squad is really that balanced. I think there's some areas where I think they've missed a few tricks. And, you know, even with, you know, in regards to set pieces now, you know, who's going to take them apart from, let's say, you've really got only, for me, I'm trying to look here. James Ward-Prowse would be someone I would look at to come in if there is any more injuries, because he can deliver and he's a great set piece. And if you really take anybody out of there, like, there's no one really else you can actually put in there that can actually do it now. So, and I think the key to the whole thing for the England, for me, is the midfield and Declan Rice and his role in there with Mount, Bellingham, and one or two others. Harry Kane's going to be obviously key as well. So, I mean, that goes without saying.
Yeah, of course. And a win over Austria. And it should be said that an Arsenal player did score that goal. Bukayo Saka scored, and he looks good. Don't know if he'll start, but he's given Gareth Southgate something to think about off the bench. Scotland with a very credible 2-2 draw in Netherlands, but Memphis Depay with an amazing late strike. And how far has he come since he was kind of toiling at Manchester United? And of course, Wales, unfortunately, Dino, sunk by a very powered up, you know, French team with, you know, Griezmann and Mbappe and Dembele on the score sheet. Probably not one that you'll lose too much sleep over. But Rob, it's getting pretty close now, and even I'm getting a bit excited about the tournament.
Oh, excellent, mate. We're all getting very excited. Well done, Derek. Well done, Dina. All right, stick around. We're going to wrap up this show with a bit of stoppage time action after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio NTS News Talk Sport. Has been a busy show, as it always is. Fourth official's given us 9 minutes, and we're going to talk about whether football players should be compelled to give interviews at various stages of matches, before, after. Well, we see it during these days, in the wake of the Naomi Osaka walkout of the French Open. So, where do you want to start this, Derek?
It's caused a very broad discussion. A lot of people coming out in Osaka's defence and being very sympathetic, not just on the issue of mental health and how players should be, or competitors should be treated, but also just the role of this in these kinds of interviews in sport in general. I mean, we get bombarded with them every day and every week, whether it be press conferences or pre-match interviews, which generally are just, in football, are just normally terrible. Over here, we have mid-match interviews, which Australia's actually, I think, innovated in AFL, and cricket with the spider cam, and then, you know, the role of the post-match interview. So I'm just wondering, you know, whether players, when they're under pressure like that, should be compelled to front up the media, at times live television, particularly when they've just lost, or whether it's still a staple of our game. So, I mean, Ed, you're a man with a strong opinion on things. Do you think we should be looking after our players more and cutting their media responsibilities?
No, not at all. I think there's a couple of points to make. The first point is the players are the major benefactor of any increase in broadcast rights. It always finds their way into their pockets in a significant way. The more money in the game, the more money for players. So ultimately, you know, fans deserve the opportunity to have a window into their world and work out what makes them tick and how they respond to pressure and so forth. So I think we should be encouraging more and more access, and the good broadcasters and the good clubs will make that content compelling, and the ones that aren't, it's no good. But in terms of Naomi Osaka, you know, I do feel for... I think tennis is a different story because it's brutal. I mean, you can lose a massive Grand Slam match, and then, you know, 30 seconds after you lost, you're getting asked questions. Very different with team sports like football, where you've got media managers and so forth helping you manage what you're going to say and deal with it. So my heart goes out to Naomi Osaka, and I think tennis needs to probably think through that in a bit more detail, how they do it.
It was more a matter, though, as the way that her camp managed it, announcing it when the tournament started.
Yeah, if they weren't going to do it, it
should have been managed a lot better. Yeah. But I think, does the name Marshawn Lynch ring a bell with anybody? He was famously, do you know Willem? Yeah.
Yeah, you've quoted him before, I think.
Yeah, I have. He was the Seattle Seahawks player, nicknamed Beast Mode, who in the 2015 lead up to the Super Bowl, he didn't want to turn up to Media Day. So he sat at the press conference and just repeated, well, the same answer to every question: I'm just here so I won't get fined. Yeah. So I would have loved to have seen Naomi have a crack at that.
Yeah, that would have been pretty good, wouldn't it?
I think the key difference, though, between the Naomi Osaka situation and football is that football's a team sport, so if you have a player who's feeling a bit down or doesn't particularly want to speak, you can hide. Whereas the most prominent voice in the A-League, Scott Jamieson, loves it. Like, you try to take away his ability to speak to the media, he'd crack it. So, yeah, I think you can hide there, whereas with tennis, unfortunately, in the current setup, it's not the case.
honestly, has anyone ever enjoyed a pre-match interview? I mean, all they do is praise the other team and the other manager. Of course, at the end, they're slagging off the other team and the other manager, and that's the more interesting stuff. But that pre-match interview is just appalling, and I don't think any of us should be subjected to anything like that going forward. We have seen some innovation, though, Rob, in cricket, haven't we? Because they've had to do this diary room thing, and actually the players quite like it because they don't feel like it's more intimate scenario for the players. So do you think we could bring in the old diary room for something like this?
Yeah, look, I don't mind innovation. I'm dead set against live interviews during matches. I hate what the AFL do, talking to coaches and players as they walk off the ground. I know they're not the only sport that does it, because the broadcasters demand more and more content. I like your pre-match interviews, but I can't stand those.
Dino, some of the most iconic moments have come from post-match interviews. I mean, the obvious example is Kevin Keegan in 1996, and you know that, I mean, that was TV gold, even though it was car crash television. And you know, maybe Kevin on reflection probably wishes that microphone wasn't put in front of his mouth.
Yeah, look, we all remember that was a very faint, and it was a fabulous game, of course, you know, between Liverpool and Newcastle. But yeah, Kevin, I felt for him that day. But to be fair to him, he was pretty well on the front foot, and I don't think he left anything out of it. So I think it certainly got it off his chest. But I'm most probably, I mean, like, we're in media, aren't we? We're talking now on a radio show. So we have to talk and understand it. But sometimes I think, especially for the individual sports, women and men, sometimes they are shy, and that's where they do need a good manager, you know, and a media manager to be able to break through that, you know, nervousness possibly, you know, and be confident about what you're going to speak about, and hopefully not get set up too much to be answering questions they don't really know how to answer. So I'm a bit on the fence with it with sometimes, because I think, you know, it's not always easy, but look, we do it for a living, and we communicate in our workplace most of the day as well, so we're most probably more experienced nowadays than we would have been in the early, say, 70s and 80s.
But Derek, don't we love the post-match Premier League interviews, because they happen sort of 3 or 4 minutes after the final whistle, don't they? They get them just as they're sort of going back into the room. So it is. We've seen some great ones where coaches have taken on the journo asking the question, if they're saying, well, what game are you watching? I remember Roy Hodgson took someone apart. Willem, do you remember the Roy Hodgson
one? I was going to famously throw up the Roy Hodgson one. Let's not piss about, I think it was. Wasn't it, Derek?
Yeah, that was.
And he's like, let's start again. Let's rerun this press conference.
Yeah, and of course our friend Jose Mourinho was an absolute classic, and some of the looks and scowls that he gave, the contempt that he found some of those questions he was asked after the game, and of course he was chucking his team under the bus towards the end of his Tottenham tenure in those interviews. But
I do not speak. If I speak, I am in trouble.
That is exactly it. And of course, the grand master of all this, just to wrap up, was Sir Alex Ferguson. I mean, he used these. This was part of the war, you know. It wasn't just what happened on the pitch. It was strategically talking to the press afterwards and just getting little digs in and little jibes in. And he wanted to get in the head of the referee for the following week, or, you know, and that is, of course, famously why Kevin Keegan blew up, of course, because Ferguson had made a comment about Newcastle basically getting an easy win over Forest because they weren't going to bother trying. It was just some context towards the end of the season. And Kevin Keegan just absolutely lost it because he thought it was insulting to Nottingham Forest, and obviously just really got under his skin. But as we know, famously, at the Newcastle title challenge crumpled after that press conference, and Alex Ferguson was old whiskey nosy, he was holding his
old whiskey nose
high into the sky and saying, thank you very much, Kevin, and thank you very much, Sky Sports. So yes, we should keep it. Just get rid of those pre-match ones.
And on that note, we are going to wrap it up, gentlemen. Great show. Dino, thanks again, brother. We're looking forward to the Euros, mate. Wales will go okay. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, they'll be all right. Don't worry about it. As long as you've got 11 men.
Question for Dean, just a quick one. If England's playing Wales, who do you bury for?
No, I'm definitely
one word.
Wales,
one word.
But Wales first. Yes. And England second.
Okay. See you, Dino.
See ya.
Derek, thank you.
Thanks, gents.
Michael.
Well, congratulations, Rob, on your wonderful prediction that Chelsea would win.
Thanks, mate.
You've only raised it five times during the show. We might as well end on it.
I'm just flabbergasted that he's showing some at least lame attempt at humility.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Michael.
And thank you, Tamo. We're going to have a busy, busy week watching the Socceroos and the Matildas next week, and we're going to look forward to the Euros, and we're going to have 6 weeks of a football feast. And we hope you'll join us next week when we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.